Hello, fellow watch lovers, nerds, enthusiasts, or however you identify. You're listening to 40 and 20, the Watch Clicker podcast with your hosts, Andrew, and my good friend, Everett. Here, we talk about watches, food, drinks, life, and other things we like. Everett, how are you?
I'm doing really well. Did I just turn your headphones up uncomfortably loud?
They're a little loud.
I meant to bump mine, and I think I bumped yours.
That's okay.
Andrew, no, I'm doing well. You know, we had a...
It's not like last week where I was screaming in my own ears.
We had our first two proper baseball games, which has been wild, man. You know, we practice. Practice is fun. But there's never enough practices before the games start. And then the games start, and, you know, this is the first year at 90 feet, so we've got 66-foot pitching mound and, you know, whatever that is, like 400 feet from third base to first. And, you know, this is, and everybody's in the same boat, right? It's like all of these kids, barring, you know, maybe a handful of them, are like graduating. They've either just graduated last year or they've graduated this year. And so there's, you know, it's not
playing
like
full-size ball.
Playing full-size ball, right? It's not like going back to T-ball or anything, but there's like, you know, these kids are used to playing at a really, like, high level, and they're struggling again. You know, it's it's cool to see. I don't mean it's cool to see these kids struggle, but I mean it's sort of cool to, like, see these kids, like, realize, like, oh, I'm not the god. You know, I'm not Bryce Harper.
And work out the nuance of, like, suddenly your center fielder is responsible for, like, 800 square feet of earth.
Right. That's a huge difference. You know, we've got this kid, and he hits the ball a mile, and he absolutely tagged one tonight. Just tagged it.
Call that a dinger.
And it is just, like, directly to the center fielder, right? I mean, it must have gone, I don't know, 250. And just the center fielder kind of took five steps back.
Gotcha.
And it was like, oh, we're playing baseball, you know. And the, you know, and that sounds like a bad thing. And to a certain extent, it can be. And I think there's some morale issues, but it's been good for the kids to see, oh, it's them too, right? It's not just us. I think they're feeling really like, oh gosh, what are we gonna do?
Well, suddenly they're tired on their sprint to first base.
Totally.
In a way that they have never been before.
Stealing second is like,
it's an endeavor.
It's a jaunt.
Yeah.
You know, so
it's more than a little hustle.
But, you know, they're having
fun. And pitchers have to be struggling. And,
totally.
And pitch counts are hard. Catchers are struggling. I bet you see a lot more stolen bases off of errant catches at the catcher.
Totally. Not as many as you think. I mean, you do see that. We had our second game of the season. So we have games Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. We're kind of a small team. We're only 11 kids with, like, three kids that can play up.
Whew.
And we've got, like, five pitchers, so, like, we're pitching everybody,
yeah,
basically one inning, right? I get 35, we get 35 pitches out of a guy, or he can't play tomorrow. So, you know, 35 pitches, if we're lucky, we get two full innings, but that's not happening right now. You know, so we're looking at, like, an inning per guy, basically. It's rough. You know, we get to the sixth inning and it's like, all right,
you've thrown a ball.
All right, buddy. Buckle up, Buttercup. And we got this kid. He's a good pitcher, really good pitcher. He's a smart kid, good kid, good baseball player. And he tagged three guys in the first inning today.
Ooh.
And you know, it's just like, I went out and I was like, how you feeling? And he was like, I feel like I'm struggling. I was like, well, don't think about that. Just keep throwing it at him. You know, like, just trying to, like, lighten the mood, because he's like, I'm like, for me as a coach, it's like, I need all 35, buddy.
Yeah.
So I can't pull you. You're going to keep on throwing them. And you know, he calmed down and it was fine. But yeah, it's fun. This is a really fun developmental age. We're having a lot of fun. Andrew, how are you?
I'm good. It's our first real week of spring. It was 70 some degrees today.
Yeah, still not spring.
It's not spring for three more days.
That's right.
It was 70 some degrees yesterday. So tree pollen is wrecking my world.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Like, I took cold medicine and allergy medicine because I wasn't sure what the problem was.
Oh, yesterday. Yeah.
It's allergies. So I'm struggling a little bit, but I'm enjoying that. Like, I can go outside and not, I know how to use that.
You know, it's got a little bit of an interesting.
Nope. Close it.
Okay. Oh yeah.
Backhand it.
We're doing beer opening tricks here.
You know how to use a wine key.
Yeah, but
it's like offensive to me.
My wine key. This is oriented the other direction. So the beer opener on Andrew's, it opens to the.
That's like the industry standard. No, I've got
two of them. I've got two of them at the house, and they're opposite.
I have like 10.
Mine open towards the hinge.
Okay.
Yeah. I've been using the one I got at King's Estate last year, and it opens.
But you can look at that and also like see which direction.
Sure, I was fine. It didn't take that long. We would have got there. You just made a big deal about it because you like to make a big deal about it.
Yeah, that's the one. But other than that, I'm really good. I'm just, you know, chugging on along. It's St. Patrick's Day, so I made corned beef and cabbage with potatoes.
Nice.
For dinner tonight. And in honor of St. Patrick's Day, we're drinking some Guinness Extra Stout.
Oh, yeah, that's nice, too. That's nice. You were talking about Guinness in cans versus bottles. And I do like Guinness in a can, but I think the bottle, you get a really nice flavor. You get like that sort of spiky maltiness that I like.
It's funny the way different beers behave in different packages.
Sure.
Like, I know you've done side-by-sides of, maybe unintentionally, of, let's say, like Bud Light, can, bottle, draft.
Sure.
And they're all unique.
Totally, yeah.
And when I was selling beer, there were people who were like, oh, I like Busch Light out of a bottle only. Okay, and try Busch Light out of a bottle. Wholly different drinking experience.
Yeah.
Same with Rolling Rock from cans and glass. Rolling Rock out of glass, phenomenal. Out of cans, skunk butt. Yeah, it's the extra stout out of glass is really lovely. I was looking for just regular Guinness in cans, but when you buy things on March 16th,
yeah,
you can't find Guinness in cans.
Yeah.
Especially when you live in vicinity of a university.
Yeah.
So,
well, and Guinness is one of those beers too. Guinness goes to shit, I feel like, in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I do not think it sells well. Yeah, no, I'm with you. Do you know Kiwanda Cream Ale?
Yes.
Which is, what's the name of that brewery?
Pelican.
Pelican Kiwanda Cream Ale. If you've never had it, it's good. But here's what I'll say. It's amazing on draft.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it in a bottle.
It's just fine.
I don't even like it. I think it's below just fine. I will pass in a bottle, but Kiwanda Cream Ale on draft, I'll get it every time.
Oh, it's really good on draft.
Yeah.
Have you had it on nitro?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where it's really good.
Yeah.
Because then it's like you're actually drinking like
a milkshake. Yeah. And it's not like a dark beer. Anyway.
No, it's just an ale, but it's like creamy and.
In any event, we're not here to talk about beer.
Gosh, why are you rushing this? We're having a really nice time.
Baseball or bottled versus can. Rather, we're here to talk about watches. And I think we got a whole bunch of watches to talk about.
We do have some things to talk about. First, I want to just briefly touch on British Watchmakers Day happened on March the 7th. It was a sold out show, 1,850 people.
Whoa.
I know that doesn't sound very big when you consider the size of wind-up events throughout these United States, but it was a sold-out show. There are some picture reviews of it, and I am just, I love British Watchmakers Day, and one of these years, I think in the next 5 to 7 years, I will be in attendance.
That'd be cool. That'd be a fun trip. Yeah.
Yes. So like I said, 5 to 7 years, one, at least I, Everett may also join, will be attending the British Watchmakers Day because it looks like such a fun event. I love celebrating like the British national watchmaking kind of revolution that we've seen in the last several years. Maybe not revolution, revitalization. What's maybe a better word? Resurrection, perhaps. Just this new and revitalized industry that's taking root in the United Kingdom. And we're seeing really cool stuff come out of the UK in the way of watches. And I love that they are, and especially that big brands and small brands are coming together to support each other, to support this national identity of British watchmaking. I think it's really cool. Pictures of it are really fun. And that's British Watchmakers Day. Another note that it has happened. And yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about briefly. Take a look at the pictures.
You know, I think Great Britain is roughly the size of Oregon, which is to say it's about 100,000 square miles.
Yeah.
Which, and of course, it's spread over a few different land masses, right? You've got England, Scotland, Wales, but it's relatively a tiny area. I mean, I think it's like less than half of the size of Texas.
It's way smaller.
Which is, in this context, it's really cool. I think that you bring up, you know, how cool this revitalized, and frankly, I don't know enough about it to say that's a totally appropriate word, but it seems right to me. As we sit here, it seems like a relatively accurate or apt description of what's happening. But like, it just seems like Great Britain is this incredibly cool, you know, between the population and the, you know, buying power that they have, the economy that they have, they've just got this really cool opportunity for collaboration for something like the British Watchmakers Guild, right?
Guild or association? I don't know.
To just be incredibly successful. And I think that's what we've seen. You know, the United States, we've got, you know, I think something like 80 or between 60 and 80 Britons in terms of landmass. Despite the fact that we've got this American identity, we're just spread to all hell and gone. And the
40 times larger.
40 times larger than, mm-hmm. Oh, we're 40. We have 40x landmass.
Which is actually kind of surprisingly less than I would have thought.
But the reality is, for us to work with someone in, say, Louisiana, in any meaningful sense outside of like teleconference, is just, it's impossible. Like, there's no proximity. There's no,
there's like wildly different culture and even language. Like, you talk to somebody from New Orleans.
And that's true in Great Britain as well, right? Mm-hmm. The Welsh people and the Scottish people and English people are all different cultures. But I think because they're so close and unified by that British identity, I don't know. I'll stop babbling. I just think it's a really cool opportunity. And I think that they're doing a really neat thing with the way they're pushing their industry, their national industry. I love it.
Agreed.
Does that mean I have to talk about a watch?
You could, or you could talk about the thing that I figured you were going to talk about just briefly.
Oh, I don't know what that is.
Shohei Ohtani.
Oh yeah. I'm not interested.
He's a Grand Seiko ambassador, which I think is cool.
Yeah. I mean, we could talk about it.
I love Shohei.
I mean, look, I've been on the Shohei bus for years, right? I even one time got in a third party argument with one of Mike Razak's friends, who's a sports writer. I'd never have actually talked to this person, but I was like, Shohei Ohtani's the greatest baseball player, you know, maybe of all time, and nobody's talking about it. Anyway, this is a long time ago.
Have you heard of Mark McGwire or Barry Bonds or Sammy Sosa?
No, of course. I've been on the Shohei bandwagon for a long time. I think he's terrific. He's now a Grand Seiko ambassador.
A Grand Seiko global ambassador, which is interesting because it's a relatively newish thing for Grand Seiko to be doing, and to be doing it with one of the most highly paid baseball players of all time, arguably one of the more recognizable global athletes, is an interesting move. Not interesting weird, but it's a little bit out of the norm for Grand Seiko to be partnering with somebody like Shohei Ohtani. And I'm wondering if they're trying to kind of carve a path and chart a path forward into a more zeitgeist oriented, keep that luxury good label, but to the people who follow baseball, like they're trying to break into a new market, in a way that we haven't really seen Grand Seiko do. Grand Seiko has just kind of been like, hey, here's our fat watch, take it or don't, and it's expensive, and I hope you like it. But now they're pushing toward baseball fans and people who care about Shohei Ohtani, and I think that's interesting.
Yeah, and maybe it is. Andrew, I will have to admit fully to knowing very little about the economics of ambassador marketing. I just don't know the first thing, right? You know, there's obviously something to it. You know, these brands, Rolex, Omega, Breitling, etc., are very aggressive about getting the sexiest, coolest, most interesting people on earth to be ambassadors for the product. And
Shohei Ohtani is a really lovely man.
And they're paying people obscene amounts of money to do this. So the reason I say that is there must be something to it. But I personally have a hard time believing that anyone will be more likely to buy a Grand Seiko given this pretty fucking obvious ambassadorship.
I struggle to see the financial value in any watch brand ambassadorship. Right? Like, just because David Beckham wears it, I'm not going to buy it. But I think we're maybe exceptions to that rule, because we're people who obsessively research things before we buy them. Like, by the time we buy something, we're almost bored of it because of how much we know about it, how like meticulous we've been about the decision-making process to get there. It's now just sort of like the thing that we decided on because we wanted a thing. I think that we're a little bit out. We are absolutely people outside of ambassadorship influence. But I don't think we are the norm in that regard.
You know, Andrew, I think you're right. I think you're right. With that said, I also think we are both people who have a pretty sort of diverse set of experiences. And I think we've got an ability to sort of understand human nature. Not supernatural for either of us, but
mine is.
But you know, I think we understand people. My point here is that, like, some things I get, right? I get a classy billboard, for instance, or I get product placement in movies. I really, really get product placement in movies. Especially, you know, if you get the right movie, holy shit, you can make the same shitty pistol for over 100 years, and people will fucking just keep buying it, right? Sorry, Walter. But
Sean Connery used it. Goddamn.
But yeah, I don't see it. I don't see this. It doesn't feel to me like there's that same. Yeah. Anyway.
I think it's doing a thing.
Timex has released a giant green ocean plastic field watch that looks like a dive watch.
It does, because it's made of ocean plastics.
So, yeah, they're calling this the Expedition Freedive Solar, because it's a solar movement. So the Expedition Freedive Solar is an ocean plastic case and bezel and strap, ocean plastic band.
That you'll probably throw away and it will end up back in the ocean.
It is green. It's green everywhere except for 0 to 20 on the rehot, which is
kelp green.
I think gold.
I think it's kelp green. Like when the big what are those bulbous top kelps that you can smack and pop, or it's still oceany green. It's not gold. It's not yellow.
I'm just gonna disagree with you here, but
We can leave it at that. So green on green on green on green with a bit of yellow and or...
Is that color green? That's green.
Okay. I do see what you're saying. Andrew's pulled up a picture of coast kelp that is yellow, and he's calling it green to prove his point.
It's green. God, I think you're colorblind.
Okay. So everybody knows what we're talking about. I would like you all... So if you can figure out a way to communicate your disdain for Andrew's calling this green to me, I will give you Andrew's cell phone, and I'm not joking. I will give you his cell phone number to say your mean things to him. With that said,
it's green.
This watch, I think, should be really cool.
It has all the makings.
I think
all
this
the
watch
trappings
should be really cool. But it's not. I mean, it's not cool.
I don't know. At $159, I think I'm good with it. I think I like the materials being used. I think it's interesting. The design leaves a lot wanting.
Well, I'm
but
fine
it's also
with the
Timex.
Design. I'm fine with the design. Look, I actually don't mind the design.
I hate the waves on the dial.
I don't even mind that. I think the waves on the dial are fine. Doesn't bother me. What bothers me is that it's 46 millimeters wide by almost 15 thick. And it's got 50 meters of water resistance.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Like the same, this is obviously not a galley designed Timex, and nobody's suggesting that it is, but it is absurdly dimensioned. I mean, it just almost doesn't make sense dimensionally. Like you made a dive watch that's 50 meters of water resistance. And it's still 15 meters.
Because it's made out of ocean waste. There's no O-rings in ocean waste.
I mean, it's got a steel and a solar movement with silicone and silicon.
It's Timex, man. What do we expect? They're not going to slam dunk everything.
If this thing costs $35 or $49.99,
yes.
A, we wouldn't be talking about it on this show. And B, it would be like, yeah, sure, whatever, Timex. But they're marketing this.
No, if this costs $40, I would absolutely talk about this watch.
We wouldn't because, and you know how I know that, Andrew? Because Timex releases roughly 10,000 SKUs per year that are that. This is different.
But this is ocean plastic that.
This is different. This is a watch that they've got marketing ass behind, that they're pushing out to watch publications, that they are making a show of. And they're selling for $140. It's a miss. If they're pushing this out to us, I get to say Timex, you fucking swung at a miss.
Yeah, they missed that one.
Because you can go to Walmart right now, Andrew, and get the watch that you're just talking about that came out this year.
Yeah, you could go get the new Iron Man for $50. It's probably also out of ocean plastic.
But I like this. I want to really like it. But it needed to be different than it was.
It needed 100 meters of water resistance.
I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that.
Even big. Even at 46, 100 meters of water resistance, I accept. Right? The Corona Tokyo we talked about last week with its diver shroud. What was it? 48?
Yeah. Yeah, it was huge.
It was enormous.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's not the size. It's the entire package. That's the problem.
No, 46 is fine. I'd be fine with this at 46 because it's cool. I mean, it's cool looking. They just missed, right? That's all I think it is. big crown guards. It's got a sexy crown. I like the hands. I actually don't mind the wave dial.
I don't like the wave dial.
I'm not a huge fan of the digital font. I'm not a huge fan of the shape of the bezel, but I can deal with all of that.
I don't know. The shape of the bezel kind of makes the plastic feel like mid-90s.
It does feel 90s. But look at this. Look at how it dips down between 50 and 60. There's a recess. But between 0 and 20, there's no recess on the bezel.
Yeah.
You see what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's just a flat timer.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that you could, like, if you can't see, you
that's
can
how you can
that
touch,
to,
yeah, yeah. touch feel.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you can't see, like, you're not going to, I mean, maybe.
Well, but you could still use it to keep time, right?
If you could see the hands.
Well, sure. I mean, these hands are going to be loomed. I'm, you know,
But if you've got enough loom to see the hands, you're likely getting enough ambient light off of the loom of the hands to illuminate your 12 o'clock triangle. This isn't like a watch in Braille. It's a miss. I understand the design. It's meant to be like a touch feel, but unless that ring is also loomed, it's another swing and a miss.
What's next, buddy?
Okay. Since we're talking Timex, Snoopy, for all of you who live near parks and have been terrorized by pickleball, Timex is honoring that with three Snoopy pickleball releases. And I say terrorized by pickleball because in the last several years, pickleball obviously has made a big explosion in the world. I've never played it. It looks kind of dumb. I think I understand why people like it, but pass for me. But the amount of noise complaints that are generated by people who used to like living near parks where people didn't play tennis, but now they play pickleball is hysterical. And I love it because it's so dumb and so funny. That being said, Timex has released a Weekender, a Marlin Quartz, and a Marlin Automatic, all with versions of Snoopy playing pickleball. And it's just wild to me that this ridiculous tennis-adjacent sport has taken Americans by storm to such a degree that Timex has taken notice and is releasing Snoopy pickleball things. I drove to Portland a couple months ago. It was called like Pickleball World. It replaced an old sporting goods store in a mall and is just indoor pickleball courts and like a pro shop. I do not understand how that's financially viable, but people love it.
Is that at Washington Square? Where is it?
Where did G.I. Joe's used to be? Town Center.
Eastport Plaza? Clackamas Town
Bridgeport.
Center? Bridgeport. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Bridgeport, right? That's what it's called?
No. Bridgeport, yeah. Tannisbourne Town Center?
No. It's just south of Portland.
Yeah,
Tannisbourne. G.I. Joe's, wherever that fucking used to be.
Sure. Well, yeah. Tannisbourne.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
I they're fun. They're Weekender and Marlins with Snoopy playing pickleball. And they're all priced how you'd expect them to be.
No, they're not.
$169, $249.
How much is a Timex Weekender?
I think they're like $150 right now. Like MSRP from Timex, $150.
I mean, I think you can get a Weekender for like $50.
Can you? I mean, you can get versions of the Weekender probably.
I mean, what are we talking about here? I think that's crazy. I think that's
the Marlins $250. The quartz and the automatic in special editions.
So the automatic is what, $350, and the quartz is $250.
Yeah. How much is that off of MSRP for non Snoopy?
What do you mean?
How much are these?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I've got a $73 Timex Weekender on the website, and that appears to be MSRP.
Okay, so that's a lot.
Yeah,
the 37mm case.
Well, and the 250 quartz.
The Marlin quartz is
Weekender is a brass cased watch, but this is why it's cheaper. The Marlin is a stainless cased watch, and so that delta makes sense. The delta between the Weekender and the Marlin quartz. But it's still, that $250 is a fuck ton of money that watch.
These are fucking Timex special editions. This is what you pay for them.
Fucking lame, I say.
I don't disagree.
You pay $150 for a brass case Timex Weekender, I'm going to slap you in the face.
Promise?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's nuts. Yeah, no.
But these aren't, is this the brass case Weekender?
It's brass case.
Yeah, whatever. It's Snoopy special edition. That's what you pay for special editions. It's Timex. I don't like.
I don't know the brass case Marlins got some cool details. The quartz Marlin has some cool details. The automatic also kind of fun, but I think that number is absolutely
insane.
I think it makes sense.
The second's hand on the quartz marlin, I think, really gives it the poop. But the pricing, fuck that pricing.
I don't know what you want, man.
I want to watch the dozen. That's not.
I said it before we started. We're gonna have one of these nights.
$170. What do you mean you don't know what I want?
Tell me what you want.
That's $170 for a brass case,
dude. Let's move on. What do you got next?
I'm like a little like that. You don't think that's absurd?
I don't think it's
turn in your host credits.
I don't think it's not absurd.
Sorry, you have to retire.
Well, is there a pension plan for like a buyout?
Talk to Will.
Will.
Awake last year. Was it last year? Has it been 2 years now?
Ooh.
When they released the Sonmai collection?
I think it's been 2 years.
Awake. So if you don't know the brand Awake or the Sonmai, I think you'll have to go back and look, because it's a really cool brand, really cool watch. With that said, a few years ago, they released their first permanent collection, which is the Sonmai. It's Vietnamese, so I'm not
December of 24.
Okay. So just a little over, a little over a year ago. I'm not precisely certain on the pronunciation, but Sonmai is how I would say that. Which was just a gorgeous set of watches. They've released it, and some really interesting details. You know, I don't know if we ever talked about the Sonmai on the show. I think we like had it on the list several weeks in a row and just never got to it, which is too bad. But what these are is a sort of dress sport watch that's got this very sort of traditional look at first glance.
But it's also kind of cushiony and like svelte.
Yeah, 100. And as you get closer to this watch, you start to see other things that are just kind of like, so first things first, the dial texture. So what this is an applied silver leaf that's been coated with a transparent see-through sanded enamel, like multiple layer sanded.
And the tears of an angel. Oh my gosh.
Oof. The loom on these is printed Super Luminova, but it's capped by really excellent faceted polished stainless steel markers. The hands are built the same way. So when the loom is activated in the dark, it appears like a halo out from underneath and the sides of the markers and hands.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this really wicked traditional looking watch that as you get closer, like you realize the bezel is, as Andrew mentioned, sort of like cushiony and round, but also really precise. And you've got great angles here, but they're also like softened with like this Gary-esque, like illusion architecture.
The lugs have kind of like this really gentle shoulder coming off of the case.
Yeah. Woo! Yes. So anyway, really cool watches. I don't think we ever gave them the proper treatment the first time around. And maybe this isn't the proper treatment either, but we, alas, are going to talk about it because they released a new silver leaf in what they're calling Atlantis Blue. Like all of the Sonmais, this is a LJP G101 movement. This is limited.
Is this blue? Am I colorblind? Is this a me thing?
It's teal. They're calling it Atlantis Blue, but it's definitely teal.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's...
I was just about to admit that I'm wrong regarding the green.
No, I mean...
But this looks green to me also.
It does have some green in it. It's a teal. I would say this is a teal, which is to say sort of in between green and blue.
The strap is blue.
It's got this beautiful blue strap. Like all of the silver leaf Sonmais, it's got an ombre, which is not the term they use, but it sort of fades from a very bright color in the middle to almost black at the outside. Golly, this thing is gorgeous. Limited to 100 pieces. These are not super cheap. These are $2,400.
Smoky gradient is what they call the dial.
Gradient. I thought there was another term that they used. With that said, you know, at $2,400, I think you have to decide if you like this watch before you're going to get it. I'll give you some details. 316L seal, of course. It's a 39 millimeter with a very nice 45.6 lug to lug, 20 meters at the lugs. We've got a width crystal thickness at 11.8, but it's a prominently domed crystal that comes down to just under 11 at the top of the case. I think that this is absolutely fantastic. Made with traditional Vietnamese techniques on the dial, and crafted as well. So, you know, a lot of production in the case of this watch, but these dials are crafted. I just think this is terrific.
Have you watched the video on the dial crafting?
Yeah, I have.
It runs on a loop, and you could watch it for an hour. Just watching them just press the silver leaf onto the dial,
yeah,
is what dreams are made of.
And then, you know, the application of the enamel and hand sanded. I think it's like a 10-hour process, actually hands on. This thing for 10 hours.
Yeah, because this has to be hand assembled.
Yeah.
Man, this is. I've never seen the silver leaf application before. Obviously, it makes sense how they do it, but I never. If you were to say, "Hey, apply a silver leaf to this dial," that's not the solution that I would reach.
Really, just a really, really stunning watch. Andrew, what's next?
How about the Doxa Sub 200 Grand Roma Edition? So this is a new edition for Doxa, right? This is the Sub 200, and I can't think of the first of any collaborations. I'm sure they've done. Oh, who's that Florida retailer that they've done that they do? Doesn't matter. They do all kinds of collaborations with that Florida retailer, and they do special colors. This is an Italian collaboration in the Grand Roma, and it is coffee bean colored, and it's lovely. I like the 200 as a platform for collaborations. I think the entire Doxa catalog is perfect for collaborations because they have such a finite and recognizable color palette across the entire catalog that when you see any deviation, you know immediately that it is a special edition. And I think that's something you don't get with a lot of other brands doing collaborations where they have 100 different colors and 100 different SKUs and they're constantly iterating and doing limited editions. Doxa has like 12, 13 colors across every single model. And if it's not one of those, you know it's a special edition. And I think that's kind of a cool thing that they do. Because you could see a notice special edition and you might not recognize it as a special edition, or take your pick of brands that do a lot of collaborations that maybe just do a tweak on color or they change the handset or, you know, whatever. I think because of Doxa's color usage, it makes their special editions a lot more recognizable and I think maybe more fun. And I like the 200. And I challenged you that if it was anything other than a Doxa brand on the 200, I think you'd like it. And
yeah, I mean, I've been sort of negative about the 200. I don't feel strongly different, but I think when you challenged me on that, I said you might be right. It just doesn't feel like a Doxa to me. With that said, you know,
the 200 is well spec'd though.
I mean, their recent release of the 200T, I'm sort of all about. Right? Mm-hmm.
That's true. It's true. And the 750T, which I really like.
I do too.
I didn't like it that much after I tried it on. It was a little bigger than I think I would want to wear regularly.
You know, I had the opposite reaction. I put that thing on my wrist and I was pretty positive about that watch on paper. And then I put it on and I was like, oh, everybody needs to try this on.
Agreed. Because it is way more comfortable than the size spec sheet would suggest.
Yep.
It's just, I think, a little bit bigger than I would want to wear regularly.
Yeah. Well, and that makes sense to me. But I think some people, maybe not a small percentage of people, might find themselves surprised putting that watch on. Doxa just has kind of the way that C case pulls itself together, it tends to wear pretty well, even at those bigger dimensions.
So. Oh, absolutely. As a Doxa owner, I can tell you that it doesn't wear big at all.
Yeah.
I'm wearing a C63 today, and I think that it doesn't wear any bigger than this.
Oh.
At all. In the way it feels, it doesn't feel any bigger. And it is not smaller by a significant amount.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's got to be a little bit of like detachment from the dimensions. And we've talked about this a number of times, but I think we get hung up in the dimensions, right? But when you look at the watch, like the Cartier, the Santos, right? Mm-hmm. That's a watch that, like, if you tried to, on paper, choose which Santos to wear, you might struggle, because I think most people would get the large, and I think that they would find, oh, this wears bigger than I want it to. When really, you know, I think most people are better suited by the medium. I guess the point I'm trying to make is with many watches, the dimensions just don't tell the story.
Yes.
And that's not controversial for me to say, nor is it novel. I'm not.
No, but when we spend all of our time online, you know, like, best case scenario, we get to try it on first, PDF to print it out, the true size dimensions, and print out a sheet of paper and tape it up to our wrist. When we don't get to handle 98% of watches, but for special occasions, you kind of like, you build this profile around dimensions and what you want to wear and what you like based on what you already own and what you've tried on. And it is kind of an impossible task to make these significant purchases without like feeling things in the metal. Cause honestly, if I had not had the opportunity to try on a medium and a large Santos, I likely would have gone with the large, and I would have probably been almost, if not just as happy with it, because it wears so svelte and so tight. But I don't think
you'd be happy with it.
The medium is just like, I put it on, but I also knew, like, I'd put on a medium before. And I love it. The size on it is just perfect. It sucks down into my wrist.
I think if you had the large, you would regret it. I think if you had bought the large, you would regret it.
Maybe. I mean, it's conjecture.
But. It's academic for sure. Yeah. Speaking of watches that should on paper work really well, but turned out for some people didn't. A few years back, Ferrer introduced its cushion case collection, which is a lovely watch. But it winds up in the way of sort of vintage Tag Heuer feeling big. It was a 38.5 millimeter watch that wore every bit of 43.
Because it's square.
And I think that many people's reaction upon seeing it in the metal for the first time is, oh, that's a bigger watch than I expected it to be. Mm-hmm. Ferrer did, I think, the thing that they probably should have done from the get, which is release a second size of that, specifically 35 millimeters. And they've released two colors of the cushion case collection, and both of them are terrific.
Yes.
So, these...
They're really different, too.
These are titled the Furno, which is a sort of raspberry color named after Captain Tobias Furno, an 18th century navigator and Royal Navy officer who really, unbeknownst to most people, really enjoyed raspberries. The second one is...
They prevent scurvy.
The second one is a teal...
It's the fairer teal.
Belzoni, named after Sarah Belzoni, who's an English traveler and writer who lived in the 18th and 19th centuries. I don't know anything about Sarah Belzoni, nor do I know anything about Tobias Furno.
Besides, that he likes raspberries.
That was made up.
No, it's real.
Okay.
On account of the scurvy.
And they're gorgeous. These are gorgeous. I mean, they look exactly like you expect. If you know the 38.5 millimeter, you will not be even slightly shocked when you see these.
Indistinguishable, perhaps.
But you will like them. You will like them. These are gorgeous. And I think, I haven't seen these, but I think you will find that the size of these is going to be excellent. Yes. These come with the hand-wound Sellita 210-1 movement, which is a 45-hour, 4-hertz movement. And it's beautifully decorated. This is not the most handsome movement, but Ferrer, as they are wont to do, has done a terrific job decorating this movement so that it looks lovely. The crown, of course, we've got that Ferrer A laid into the steel. This is a hit for me. $1,165, which is an incredibly fair price on these, I think, given what we know about Ferrer. Great texture on these dials.
The texture on the Furno pink. So it has a pink arrow tip on the second hand, and then a much more red dial. But the texture on it is like almost severe relative to that gentle red. It kind of looks like looking at like a brain, like really deep, dark lines in it. It is gorgeous.
Yeah.
But you have to appreciate a texture dial to appreciate it, because the teal is very differently textured.
No, that's right. Yeah. It's a lighter texture.
It's a much lighter texture. And rather than being kind of randomized, like almost topographical on the red, it's closer to linear on the teal.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting decision to have such drastically different texture patterns.
So dimensionally, we're at 35 millimeters across by 38 millimeters long. If you've seen these cushion cases, they've got a very discreet and short lug to lug, 18 millimeter lugs on this, which is appropriate, although I don't think 20 would hurt it. Design wise, it might make it harder for them to fit. It might make it harder for them to get the crowns to a good size. And 10 millimeters thick, which is terrific. Only 50 meters of water resistance on this, but that's appropriate. That's what these really should be. That's fine. I think they hit this. They hit this out of the park, even though it's really just a new size. I think this is the right size. I genuinely believe that they should have led with this. This is a...
Or at least done it contemporaneously.
Cartier-Santos-Sitch.
Yeah, I think so.
Yep.
Maybe a bigger gap, though, than the dimensions on the two Santos. Even though I think millimeter for millimeter, it's probably pretty close to identical.
Yeah, yeah. Really cool. Good release by Ferrer. Smart release by Ferrer.
Serica.
Fuck yeah, dude.
5330 dive chronometer, now with a date window, which is not something that I care about, but some people do. And it is great. They did such a good job. So this is the 5330. It's a whole new reference. It is a 39 millimeter case. It's the same case as the 5303. 12.2 thick, double-domed sapphire, 46 lug-to-lug,
just like a perfectly sized, compact, svelte dive watch, two scale bezel, ceramic insert. It's all the things, and it comes on all of the Serica bracelet options that you could possibly want, 3 o'clock date window, and a COSC certified, what's the movement they're running?
It's the Kinesi.
It's the Kinesi. Kinesi?
I think so. Am I just making this up?
Soprod M100.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's the Soprod M100, COSC certified, not COSC plus, 300 meters of water resistance. Why does that keep powering up?
Yeah, I don't know. Andrew's got a ghost in the machine.
In my printer.
Is it going to print something? Should we just unplug it?
Hard to say.
Can you hear that at home, folks? Can you hear that? No, Andrew, how many... So, I am struggling.
Wait. $1,690 on this for a COSC certified 300 meter dive watch.
Yeah, but that's just Serica stuff. Hold
but it's that's, no, but that's a good, like, that's good.
Well, that's just Serica stuff. I mean, that's right. I think what I was hoping that we would get to here with this is how bizarre a release this is. How many brands can you off the top of your head think of that could release a watch that, and we'll talk about the differences, but it's virtually indistinguishable from their prior releases, and they added a date window, and we'd be like, A, that's cool, and it's notable. B, they really did a good job with this. And C, I didn't make me feel like shutting my computer and crying.
Tudor released blue and broke the internet.
And we made fun of it because it was kind of annoying.
And like then Will Tudor bought one and he was like, hey, the blue's pretty okay.
Will, go away. Tudor, go away. No. So, first...
I never even considered that it was lacking a date window. It never even occurred to me.
Here's what I will say. This is done in a perfectly Serica way, which is to say not outrageous, not bold. In fact, opposite of bold might be appropriate. It is tasteful.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It's tasty.
Tasteful. They have added this thing tastefully. It is just a 3 o'clock marker date window. It's got slightly rounded corners on the date window. It's a rectangle with just ever so slightly rounded corners, which if you never thought, if you didn't know you needed that, go look at the swatch and now you'll know. They did it in red, which in terms of, that's pretty wild for Serica.
That is the wildest thing they've ever done.
There's a couple of other things that are notable here. The Serica dive watches in the past have all come with a glossy dial. This has a matte dial.
Mm-hmm.
Which is beautiful. Furthermore, the case on this is all satin versus the brushed and polished combinations that Serica normally runs. So a little bit different feel on this watch. I'm pretty impressed by how restrained this release is. And I don't mean, that sounds a little stupid. I realize that and I'm sorry. But I saw this and I was taken aback by the restraint and the tastefulness of this release.
I feel like that's everything Serica does.
Yes.
It's just an exercise in pure restraint. Like they take it right up to the edge, back it off three notches, and release really, really attractive, really refined, familiar, but innovative watches. I love them. Serica can do no wrong.
You might be right about that, Andrew. This is perhaps proof of that. Andrew, we're getting long in the tooth here. There's at least one of your watches that I haven't read about, and so I can't really talk about. But I think we should talk about, but that means you have to talk about it. The F77 Mark II.
Oh yeah. So, I feel like I'd seen this watch before, but I don't remember us ever talking about it or thinking about it. So the Mark II is this sort of bizarro integrated sports watch, octagonal bezel that we all know. And it's a 38 millimeter case. It's 12.1 thick, 46.2 lug to lug. So it's like sort of the Goldilocks sizing for an integrated sport watch. It's 100 meters of water resistance. Soprod P024 automatic movement, 38 hours of power reserve. These are 1,500-ish euros. And this is now on, they've released now an aventurine for it, which is something that I never thought that I would need in this like linear, polished sport watch case with aventurine that just like makes me feel like I'm looking out of the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon. This seems like maybe the most densely packed aventurine dial I've ever seen. And that's what really, really caught my attention. Because aventurine is variable. This is dense aventurine. And I'm smitten.
I do think we talked about the stone dial releases a few weeks ago.
Did we?
We talked about the green aventurine.
Yeah.
You know what? When I saw this, I thought, is this different? I think that this may just be a release in that same line. In fact, I think this was announced at that time. I'm still glad we talk about it again, because what a great release. Up to 38 millimeters on the diameter of this, down to 12.2 from 12.65 on the thickness. Mm-hmm. Great price.
I forgot we did talk about that. Yeah.
And that, Andrew, that aventurine, you know, I think on their product photos, it looked really dark. But on the hands-on photos that we've got from time to time,
bright.
Yeah, it's got a really lovely sheen. And, you know, of course, aventurine is going to be, you know, unique piece to piece. And so maybe there's some color variations. But I'm glad we're talking about this again, because it's sort of mind-blowing. If 1,360, if you're in the market for... If you're in the market for an almost integrated steel sport watch,
yeah,
man,
it's got like a collar to make it look integrated, but it's not quite.
Yeah, and I think it still is, right? You couldn't just jam a 20 millimeter dress strap in there.
It's a 22, and I think,
is it 22 across?
It's 22, and I think you could, because if you look at the. If you look
at
the straps,
22 across.
That's what it says. It says in the spec sheet, it's 22 across. So it's got like a collar on the bracelet, and they have integrated straps for it. But I think if you were to just put this on a 22 millimeter, I mean, based off of their, maybe they're measuring 22 to the outside of the.
What they say 22 millimeter lug width, but that does not look like 22 to me.
I think it's worth a consideration that. It looks like 18 to me.
It looks,
but like if you were to put this
14 to me,
but if you were to put it on a strap, I don't know. I need somebody to put some calipers to it.
Yeah. I'm
and clarify, because I think it's probably 22 to the outside of the strap.
Okay.
But if you look at the underside,
I think that's what it is. I think you're right. It's 22 to the flank, to the outside of the flanks on the strap, is my guess.
Yeah, because even the it's like a false collar on the, if you look at the underside of the bracelet, yeah. The end link.
Well, cool watch.
The adventure on this is phenomenal.
I saw it on your list, and I thought, well, I kind of like to talk about that. The only other watch that I really want to talk about today is the new Raketa. So when I got into watches, there was like Seiko. There was Orient. there was Vostok, right? And then somewhere along the way, there was also, you know, as a TBWS guy, like Russian watches come up frequently in their early shows, and perhaps still now, I can't say for certain. And Rocketta came up quite a bit, and I was always interested. I was already sort of like adjacently interested in Rocketta, but didn't really ever get there. Turns out Rocketta still just humming along, and turns out Rocketta making kind of rad.
Yes.
Making kind of rad watches. They just released a watch to celebrate the 65th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's first man in space flight, which is to say first man to reach outer space and orbit the Earth. Although to be in orbit of the Earth, I guess, is more appropriate.
To orbit the Earth, I think, is the way it's phrased.
And so they've released a 24-hour timekeeping watch to celebrate that. And it is really excellent looking. It looks like it's incredibly well made, which if you're anything like me in looking at this thing, that is a slight surprise to you. No offense to the Rocketta folks, none intended anyway. Ran in a 24-hour timeout. They're calling this the Baikonur, which I'm sorry, I don't know what that means, and I should have looked it up.
My guess would be the Bai time zone.
It is a 24-hour dial complemented by a second 24-hour inner bezel. No fourth hand.
The Baikonur Cosmodrome is the world's first and largest operational space launch facility located in the southern Kazakhstan.
There you go. Local time tracked on the primary dial on the 24-hour scale. The second crown is used to adjust the inner bezel to set a second time zone. We've got daytime and nighttime hours that are indicated on both, executed in white and black. Huge and bold red accents here. And then we have a... What is it? It's got a solar calendar that you can use theoretically if your instruments are fucked and you need to like hand navigate from space back to Earth. So
I think at that point you just accept that you're going to die. Your Rocketta is not going to save you, man.
We've got Superluminova on the hour markers for the nighttime of local time, but not for the daytime of local time, which is cool. And then we have a solar compass. Well, the idea is that if you're traveling in space and you're returning to Earth,
you just point it at the Earth
and have damaged equipment, this compass could, you know, sort of like allow you to get your bearings when you land, you know, in who knows, God knows where. Okay, fine. Thanks, Rocket. It is an automatic. Interestingly, automatic watches don't work in space. Yes. Because of gravity. So they've got a decoupler that can be used in hand-wound mode that decouples the watch from the automatic function, theoretically, to prevent excess wear and tear. It is an in-house movement. The caliber 2624 CA. I'd be lying if I told you I knew even the first thing about that caliber. What I can tell you is it's not a bad looking caliber.
No, it's lovely.
And these are, you know, about $3,000 for a 42 millimeter dual crown 24 hour format watch with 200 meters of water resistance. And I want one almost just because I'm like, yeah, I mean, you'll never meet another person that has this.
Unless you meet Soviet cosmonaut.
It maybe even then.
Yeah, they probably don't have these.
They probably can't afford it.
They get
Mandatory gifted them because it's named after their launch pad in Kazakhstan.
I don't know that that's how Russia works.
I mean, I don't know either. I've never been. I think it'd be cool. I'd love to see the Red Square.
This is a really cool watch.
It is a really cool watch. The internal rotating bezel, the kind of novel GMT functionality that they have applied here is cool. The design on it is just, it looks very, very Soviet. And it's not, it doesn't look Russian. It looks very Soviet, like very Raketa, very 80s Soviet with all of the modern flourishes, some novel design ideas. I don't understand the solar compass, but I think it's just because I'm not smart enough to understand space flight. I feel like if you're lost, you just point it
at it's just a compass. It's not a space flight. It's just a compass that uses the light to tell you where to go, right? It's like a compass bezel.
I feel like it should be more complicated than
I don't think it is.
I accept, but I feel like it should be.
Yeah, fair enough.
Right? Like, if you're going to call something a solar compass, like, pointed at the bright thing is not a solar compass. That's just being a moth.
Andrew, I think you've gotten through about half of your watches. I got through about three-fourths of mine.
I'm done.
Okay. I mean, there's some other really cool stuff on your list.
I already closed the tabs.
Okay, fair enough. Other things, what do you got?
So, as I said earlier, today is St. Patrick's Day. So, as with every St. Patrick's Day, I made corned beef and cabbage. I typically brine my own brisket flat. I just didn't know. I lost track of time and didn't get a chance to go buy a brisket, didn't get a chance to get a brine made. So I bought a pre-packaged brisket flat from a company called, and it's a brand that I've bought before, and I'm always a little embarrassed, from a brand called Blarney Stone. They have it at Winco. It's like $20 for enough brisket for dinner for four, and then like some leftovers. It's almost as good as doing it yourself. You just put it in the slow cooker, add some water, add the seasoning packet. It's already brined. Because all a brine is just salt and seasoning. You need to do nothing. I threw it in my slow cooker. My wife threw it in the slow cooker this morning because I forgot to do it before I left to work. She turned it on low. I got home from work. I threw the cabbage and potatoes in, turned it on high for like three more hours. And it was fantastic. As much as I will always advocate for doing it yourself and doing the scratch thing because it feels better, even if it doesn't necessarily taste better, if you're not in the mood to give up 5 pounds of space in your fridge for a week, Blarney Stone flat pre-corned beef is terrific. I'm all about it. I'm embarrassed to say it's almost, if not as good as mine. It's indistinguishable in my family, so that makes me think that it's maybe just as good. But I don't feel as good as about it.
I can feel that. Yeah, I mean, you said, like, it's almost as good. And I was like, I'm sure it's exactly as good.
It's different.
Sure, because you didn't do it.
Well, but the nuances aren't there. And what I will say, too, is that when I slow cook mine, the vegetables come out better seasoned.
Fair enough.
I don't need to season the vegetables at all.
Yeah, fair enough.
When you slow cook this one, you do need to season the vegetables after they come out or before they go in. Take your pick. But it's not quite as well seasoned, but the brine is there. The curing is there. But it just has less, like, the peaks and valleys are narrower.
Andrew, how much do you know about wine?
Wine?
Yeah, wine.
Like how to drink it?
Sure. I mean, just like,
I am above average knowledgeable about wine.
Because
of things that I've done in the past. Like
experience in the industry.
And then subsequently the interest that evolved from that and just kind of like maintained.
I am not unfamiliar with wine. I'm not unfamiliar with wine, but I'm also not a wine aficionado.
Yeah.
Which is to say, like, I know the names of a handful of wines. I know that I like this with that, and I like this with that. And by this, I mean, there's like five wines that I'm familiar with. And so when I open up a wine menu, you know, it's... anyway, long story short, Kim and I went to an Italian restaurant in Ashland this last weekend. And I'm just going to, so I'll just start by saying, and then I'll end that part of the conversation. I'm going to start by saying, this was the best Italian food I've ever had in my life.
The pictures looked amazing.
It's called Osteria La Bricola, and it was absolutely
the brick oyster.
Phenomenal. They have a carpaccio appetizer that's served with like a fondue drizzle on top. Holy shit. Like, I could just eat that. Like, if you were like...
It looked like a carpaccio plate that you should just roll up and eat like a beef roll up.
I mean, there was a half a mind to do that. Pounded just as absolutely thin as it could be, but not beaten through anywhere. It was terrific.
It didn't look pounded. It looked like it was probably like...
Pressed, maybe.
Pressed, like sliced and pressed.
It might be.
Because there was not any texture to it. It was just so thin. Yeah, it looked really, really
good. It was so fucking good. Anyway, I'll leave the food alone for a second. But I was looking at the wine menu, and, you know, of course, I'm looking for like the half dozen things that I'm familiar with, right? And our gal came out. So first, our server was probably like 11 years old. And I was like, how the fuck is this person old enough to serve alcohol?
You're in Southern Oregon, man. They ain't no rules.
And she comes out and she's like, if you have any questions, I'm pretty familiar with our wine menu. And I'm like, yeah, right, lady. But she was like a little aggressive, like, let me help you pick wine. And so we're like, fuck, sure, whatever. And, you know, go ahead. Like, I was almost like a little irritated. You know, I wasn't irritated, but I didn't want it.
You were a little defensive because you felt like she wasn't old enough to actually know enough to talk about it to help you.
And so anyway, she's like, well, what are you going to get? And we're talking about what we're going to get. And she sort of brings us to this section of wines.
You had a diverse menu, right? Like, to move from carpaccio into like a pasta dish. And I don't remember what the other thing was.
Yeah, we had the wild boar tagliatelle and a dark mushroom risotto. But
why did you do that? The way you said risotto.
Risotto?
I hate that.
I mean, I think that's how you...
I'm going to flick you right in your nuts. Continue, but...
I think that's how you say it.
Yuck.
What are you offended about?
You don't speak Italian. You don't have to, like, accent things. It's risotto.
All right.
Risotto. Got your dick. Parmesan. Mozzarella.
And anyway, she came out and she was like, this wine Nebbiolo, I've never heard of this. You know, there was a couple different kinds of Barolo, but there's Nebbiolo proper. And she said, you know, based on what you're getting, I think this is what I recommend. It is really light in color, like, because I said, well, I like a Pinot Noir, but, you know, it's you know, more for a lighter meal. We're kind of going heavy tonight. I do like a Syrah, but I think that's too heavy. And she's like, I want you to try this wine. I think you'll try it. We spent too much. We, you know, got the upgrade version of it. And
she got you.
Dude, this was it. So not knowing anything about wine, this is my other thing for the night. I think my other thing is maybe like it wine's really interesting. And if you've ever sort of been wine curious, it was a lot of fun to have a new wine from someone who knew about wine, who was recommending it to us. But also, like, Nebbiolo kind of blew my mind because it's very light, but it has this brightness and acidity that felt really light. But then, like, at the end, it got like really like earthy and licorice flavor. Like, it's this full like roller coaster of wine. And I just think it could pair with a billion different meals. You know, like I would drink this with steak. I would drink this with oysters and not even think twice about it. It is my favorite wine I've ever had. And I'm not going to say what I got specifically, although
Nebbiolo is interesting because it's kind of familiar flavor profile to like, but like most Americans are not familiar with like Spanish and Italian wines, right? We drink a lot of French wines and a lot of American wines because they grow at similar latitudes, right? Similar latitudes. So we're really familiar with French and American wines that are derived from French wines. Italian wines are phenomenal. Nebbiolos are closest comparable to like a Pinot Noir, but they have a much, they're punchier, I think, in the ways that you want them to be. And I think just a little bit deeper. I think Pinot Noirs are like, I think they're kind of flat. I don't super dig Pinot Noirs. They sort of seem one dimensional. Nebbiolos are not like that.
Definitely not. I don't think Pinot Noirs are flat, but I do. I was really blown away by this wine. And now I'm like, everywhere I go, I'm going to be like, what Nebbiolos do you have? And then pretend like I know anything about what they have and order the one that's the price I want.
They probably don't, because Italian wines just aren't that popular, at least where we are. Even at Italian restaurants, they tend towards French wines because that's what people are familiar with.
Sure.
Here in the Pacific Northwest, because all of our big Oregon vineyards are French wine or French grape derived. And I think that's a big loss for a lot of Americans, because the French wine industry has the real stronghold here, and we lose out on a lot of really great wine culture throughout the rest of the world, because Italian and Spanish wines are fucking phenomenal, and they're so different and familiar, but they're just really different and exciting. And I'm really glad you got to experience an exciting new wine, because very much like experiencing an exciting new liquor, that's virtually the same, yeah, but different.
Yeah.
Like you just tried a slightly different grain bill in this wine. You're like, totally. Oh fuck, this is wholly different and amazing. And I've been missing out. That's awesome.
Yeah. That's what happened. Yeah. It was cool. And you know, Kim of course was like, oh, this is good. I like this. I'm like,
but your palate has been trained by, you know, a lot of different whiskeys to, sure,
coffee and whiskey and beer
and cigars and tobacco and these things that you try and experience and learn about to isolate flavor profiles and to like find the line through your tongue. I think that's really cool.
But I was like, I'm like, oh, you know, can I get like, you get that little licorice on the end? And she was like, no.
I get carpaccio on the end.
She's like, there's no licorice. And I'm like, well, it's not licorice, but you know, it's a little. And she's like,
a little fennelly. Yeah,
no, I don't.
That's just training your palate. I have had a couple Nebbiolos. I don't know what bottle you had, but I've only had a couple, and I really liked them. And I think they're most easily comparable to a Pinot Noir.
Yeah, it very very good, like a Pinot Noir, but like with a little bit more.
Little junk in the trunk.
Are you ready for it? Terroir. Oh,
I hate that.
Hey, folks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of 40 and 20 of the Watch Clicker podcast. Do me a favor. Go to our website, watchclicker.com. That's where we post articles and reviews and things about watches that are usually written. And also pictures. If you want to follow us on social media, you can do that on Instagram at watchclicker or at 40and20_watchclicker. That is where we post photos and other things about watches or what we're doing on the website and this podcast. If you want to support us, and oh boy, we hope you do, you can do that at patreon.com/40and20. That is how we get all the money we need to get this thing, to keep this thing moving, hosting for both the podcast and photos and website maintenance. It costs a lot of money. All of those who are supporting us, we thank you so much. If not, go check it out, patreon.com/40and20. And don't forget to tune back in next Tuesday for another hour of watches, food, drinks, life, and other things we like.
Bye-bye.